Thank you, Tom, but you know, if I had thought you were going to begin a push to have me canonized, I would have returned to the church a lot sooner. The late Mel Bradford astutely remarked that not every Southerner who counts himself a conservative qualifies as a Southern conservative. In fact, Bradford was firing more broadly. Against right-wingers who devoutly support Marxist economics and just love big business. He described them as, quote, centralizers who are egalitarians on every subject except money. Now, Mel Bradford, like the Southern agrarians and Richard Weaver before him, spoke for a Southern conservative tradition that harked back to John Randolph of Roanoke and John C. Calhoun. It rejected capitalism's substitution of marketplace consumer values for the society and values based on religious and historically grounded moral principles. It has rejected a radical individualism that places personal expression above social order. And it has advocated a broad private property in a market economy, subject to socially determined moral restraints. Reflecting on the radical egalitarianism that imposed the guillotine and the reign of terror, Southern conservatives have stood for strict interpretation of the original Constitution, defended states' rights, and insisted upon respect for local cultures in opposition to the centralization of power in Washington. Accordingly, Southern conservatives have supported capitalism against socialism to the extent that it continues to preserve the ideal and some of the substance of private property, and have supported a market economy in preference to state-planned economy to the extent that market mechanisms generate equity and justice. They do not share the rights romance with the free market, and they detest much of the ideology that flows from it. In their view, the bureaucratization and centralization of big business constitute an alternate version of socialism and an invitation to political tyranny. Now, it's easy to misunderstand this hostility to the marketplace. After all, the South long stood proudly for free trade and staunchly opposed tariffs and other forms of government interference with supply and demand. But the central issue has never been the economy as such, the marketplace for commodities. Rather, it has been the marketplace for morals and spiritual values, and the reduction of just about everything to consumer choice. Now, I said all of this at length in my books, The Southern Tradition and The Southern Front, which I have no doubt you have all read and memorized. I trust, therefore, that I need not apologize if my remarks today pass into reflections on the somber events of September 11th. A preliminary observation. Neither during the Cold War nor since have Southern conservatives been insensible to the moral dimension of international politics. But they have arguably taken sounder Christian ground than the neo-evangelicals with whom they're sometimes allied. They accept the Christian doctrines of original sin and human depravity, even if some translate them into secular terms. But they have always regarded with suspicion the notion that one people has the right or the power to impose its social and political system on another. They hated communism as the embodiment of a Gnostic arrogance manifested in a centralized state that subjected the individual to tyranny. But they responded primarily to the direct military threat it posed to our own society and people. Then and since, Southern conservatives have been hostile to holy wars, which they readily associate with Sherman's March to the Sea. And hence, many denounced the Gulf War as imperialist, while others who supported intervention reasoned that Saddam Hussein's regime did indeed pose a threat to the security of America and its allies. Both groups, in short, rejected the ideological rationale as presumptuous. Now, the Gulf War, curiously enough, was something of a replay of events that started in 1848 and went on for a few years. When Americans deeply sympathized with the Hungarian revolutionaries crushed by the army of Tsarist Russia, Louis Kossuth, the much-acclaimed Hungarian leader, pleaded for American intervention, made a grand tour of the United States, very popular in the North, not so popular in the South. In a typical Southern response, Colonel B.F. Hunt of Charleston lashed out at Kossuth's unmitigated vanity and mischievous conceit, quote, "It is a spirit that would lead us into crusades to liberate the serfs of Russia, to restore nationality to Poland, to staunch the bleeding of oppressed Hungary and Ireland, to succor the wretches who toil in dreary mines and waste away in the crowded factories of England, and even to rescue the beautiful victims of Turkish grossness from their harems. It is sheer madness." Well, a bit hyperbolic and flowery, but not exactly stupid. Nevertheless, William Henry Trescott of South Carolina, a great if forgotten man, who was an experienced diplomat and America's first great diplomatic historian, he laid out a different view, which attracted increasing support in the South. He argued that the Monroe Doctrine relegated the isolationism of Washington's farewell address, negated. Europe's quarrels spilled over into Latin America and the Pacific and threatened American commercial and political interests. George Washington's greatest accomplishment, in his view, in foreign policy, was to keep out of European wars in which America could gain little and might become a cat's paw of England and France. But now, by 1848, the power of the United States was waxing, and it could not ignore European quarrels that manifestly threatened our national interests. Looking back on the French Revolution, Trescott applauded the intervention of the conservative powers in the internal affairs of France on the grounds that the revolutionaries were threatening the social order of Europe. The war was therefore a war for European survival. And national self-preservation required intervention against nations that exported revolutionary ideologies. For what it's worth, you might recall that during the 1930s, the South rallied to Franklin Roosevelt's call for opposition to Nazi aggression earlier and more strongly than any section of the country. Now, the critique of the dominant Southern conservative view by Trescott, himself in most respects a quintessential Southern conservative, should give us pause. For the great problem with Southern conservative thought has always been that its impressive diagnoses of modernism, indeed of modern Western civilization, has not included practicable solutions, at least not that most people can swallow. And that failure, in my view, largely accounts for the readiness ever since and today of instinctively conservative Southerners to support any number of anything but conservative politicians and policies. To begin with, the conservative South judged the march of the marketplace as a march not so much of commodities, but of every aspect of life. The commodification of the family and community, of morals and mores, of God himself. Well, what did antebellum Southerners, and I do love them, what did they offer us as an alternative? They offered us slavery. And do not kid yourself, the prevalent theory of the day did not merely justify the enslavement of blacks, but a biblically and historically sanctioned reduction of labor to personal servitude. Slavery, subsequent racial segregation, and much else offered a vision impossible to sustain and an evil that turned out to be a cure that turned out to be worse than the disease. Now consider the doctrine of states' rights and the decentralization of political power. Trescott had no patience with any of it. He argued that a nation state could survive in the modern world only with concentrated political power and the ability to move as a coherent unit. Now, Trescott was an ardent secessionist. He opposed American national consolidation, not on principle, but on grounds of strategy and tactics. States' rights protected Southern property and institutions in a hostile environment. That is, a union controlled basically by the North. But he argued it would prove a fetter to an independent slaveholding Southern republic. Thus, he concluded that an independent Confederacy would have to centralize political authority or be ground to powder. Analogously, Southerners who continued to support states' rights and resist the concentration of power in Washington have been quick to demand federal aid of all kinds for all sorts of things. It's pointless to denounce them as hypocrites. They do want the federal government off their backs. They do want as much local control as possible, but they have wide and deep problems that require government aid, and they have not yet been shown that the direct support of the federal government can be dispensed with. Even the decentralization of a so-called new federalism generally turns out to mean that states administer and finance programs basically dictated by Washington. Or take the Southern conservative attack on finance capital. The agrarians and their successors offered a return to small business and a vast broadening of property ownership, which looked like a will-o'-the-wisp then and looks worse in these days of conglomerates and worldwide economic integration. To resist, to impose restrictions upon the political as well as economic behavior of international capital surely would require strong national governments. A final example. Consider the admirable and courageous refusal of Southern conservatives to submit to the egalitarian swindle. All the more admirable and courageous in the face of the capitulation of most of the American right. Bradford, who called equality the real opiate of the masses, ridiculed as patent nonsense the allegedly self-evident truth that all men are created equal. Is there anybody who really believes that, by the way? I know we all preach it, but no two men, he insisted, have ever been equal in any sense other than in their possession of the spiritual worth in the eyes of God. And no one on the left overmatched Bradford in shredding that derivative swindle, equality of opportunity, which he denounced as demagogy resting on the preposterous projection of an unattainable level playing field for individuals and groups. The left, he argued, stands for equality of condition, and that cannot be implemented and can only embitter those seduced by its promises. All of which makes sense to me, but no one has yet figured out how to bell the cat, especially in the South, where a certain kind of anti-egalitarianism goes hand in hand with a certain kind of egalitarianism that proclaims fiercely, I'm as good as anybody. And there is, of course, a deep distrust to any kind of what would appear to be elitist or aristocratic pretension. Now, I have argued that the Southern version of conservatism deserves close reexamination for its many insights, even if we cannot accept the often utopian solutions that accompany some impressive social analyses. Meanwhile, the events of September 11th compel a sober appraisal of the spirit that has distinguished its long, brave, and bold, if sometimes tragically wrong-headed, defense of Western civilization. For a defense of Western civilization has always been at the heart of Western conservatism. The radical left-wing theorist Noam Chomsky has been quoted as describing September 11th as, quote, an atrocity answering American atrocities. I think we're going to be hearing that in various versions. Now, presumably, Mr. Chomsky was alluding to the slave trade to the Indian Trail of Tears, to Hiroshima, to Vietnam, and the like. Yet it's not at all clear that American atrocities, real and imagined, much concern the terrorists. Since it's wise to try to put yourself in the head of your enemies, I'm going to try to do that. And please bear with me if I now play Bin Laden and explain our cause to you infidels. Of course, we're going to rag you about American atrocities. It's the smart move. Since so many of your people are whining guilt trippers, it'll work. But we know that Islam conquered much of the world under the glorious banner, Islam, tribute, or the sword. We didn't distribute roses and chant, "Let's give peace a chance." All great peoples, civilizations, empires, nations, arise drenched in blood. Americans have not done worse than others. Your idiots like to wring their hands over the African slave trade. But we Arabs beat you to it and set the pace for your atrocities. Incidentally, how come no one is demanding that we pay reparations? Allah knows we're rolling in oil money. Now, it's your culture we hate. And admit it, it has become a pretty hateful culture. You are outraged because we killed a few thousand people. Have you counted lately the number of babies you slaughter every day, declaring it your right to do so, and with the cool explanation that babies are not babies whenever the Supreme Court says so? If you want to raise your children in a five-gendered pigsty, replete with every kind of filth, that's your business. Have a good time. But when you export your culture of death, when you parade every form of moral degeneracy on TV and package it with Coca-Cola as freedom of choice, then it becomes our business. And before we let you do that to us, we'll kill you or die in the attempt. Countless Americans hate what we hate. Certainly your conservatives claim to, and your southern conservatives shout their outrage from rooftops. The late Murray Rothbard, who practiced what he preached, declared, "To be a libertarian does not mean to be a libertine." But when freedom becomes license, when it is not checked by the imposition of objectively grounded moral standards, checked by what Richard Weaver called social bond individualism, then you effectively grant everyone the right to be a libertine. You Christians used to believe in original sin. Many of you still do, especially in the South. Flannery O'Connor was right when she remarked that a great many Southerners, unlike many Northerners, still believe in original sin. So why do I have to explain that if you turn morals, religious faith, and everything else into commodities to be picked up or dropped according to consumer choice, you should not be surprised when people buy filth instead of decency? What do you expect? Filth is a lot more fun. Now, I don't suppose I got Bin Laden's accent right, and I doubt that he speaks Arabic with a Brooklyn accent in any case. But what really bothers me is that I regularly applaud some version of that speech from Randolph or Calhoun, from the agrarians, from Weaver and Bradford. Listen to Weaver. Quote, "Modern man has become a moral idiot. For four centuries, every man has been not only his own priest, but his own professor of ethics. And the consequences is an anarchy which threatens even that minimum consensus of value necessary to the political state. We must ask in all seriousness whether men any longer even want to live in other than a state of animality." Now, Weaver wrote that a decade before the 60s, before the numbing onslaught of cultural nihilism hit full speed. As for Bradford, at the end of his life, he wondered aloud just what conservatives wanted to conserve in our decadent culture, and he proudly redefined himself as a reactionary. Now, Weaver did something else. He hammered at the prostitution of language. That came back to me during the past week when I gagged upon hearing horrific and normalcy, and worse, the trivialization of tragedy. But I especially gagged on the countless references to the alleged cowardice of the terrorists. Would somebody please tell me how a man who is willing to sacrifice his life for his beliefs rates as a coward? When people do that for better causes, let's say for freedom, they're heroes and martyrs. Have we then capitulated to the monstrous doctrine of situational truth and situational morals? Whatever may be said about today's terrorists, they include many extraordinarily brave men. And no, I do not question for a minute that their heads have to roll. Rather, I ask you to recall the passion with which John Randolph and John C. Calhoun, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, and a host of others pronounced the word duty and declared it the most important word in the English language. And recall the stubborn devotion to duty, the sheer heroism with which a beleaguered Southern people withstood 4 years of terrible warfare against an enemy with immeasurably superior resources. The new kind of war we are being called upon to fight has much in common with all previous wars, has this much in common. It cannot be fought, much less won, by people who see nothing in life worth dying for. And the situational truth that denies objective truth and absolute value in the world, that miserable doctrine our young people have been force-fed during the last 30 years of cultural revolution, contains nothing any sensible man or woman would die for. The calls for and the impressive demonstrations of national unity have been heartwarming and should be encouraged. But the question remains, unity for what, other than physical survival? This war has to be fought on two fronts, abroad and at home. The Bin Ladens have raised the banner of social order against rampant nihilism. We cannot meet that challenge by shouting our devotion to a freedom that has become flagrant license. The problem has always been, for us and for every society, to balance the claims of social order with those of individual freedom. Whatever has been wrong with the solutions proposed by Southern conservative spokesmen, whatever has been wrong with the often rigid responses of the Southern people, no region has outdone the South in stubborn adherence to religious faith, in resistance to political tyranny, and in readiness to fight and die. If we are going to defeat terrorism abroad, we'll have to build what we've called that minimum consensus of value necessary to the political state. And in that task, I would suggest we begin our project by looking south.